When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
It's that time of year again. There's a nip in the air, the holidays are in full swing, and you are halfway through another academic year. And that means AppSite 2022 is right around the corner. Fear not, Behind the Knife has got you covered. We've got over 28 high-yield AppSite review episodes and our trusty companion book available on Amazon. Everything you need to dominate the AppSite. Don't forget to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org, where you can easily access all of our podcasts and videos, register for free CME, and sign up for the BTK newsletter. And be sure to keep an eye out for our comprehensive oral board review material, which is due out in early 2022. If you appreciate what we're doing here at Behind the Knife, please leave us a 5-star review. Now, take a deep breath. You've got this.
Welcome back to Behind the Knife. I just want to thank everyone that's gone on our iTunes and given us a 5-star review there, and on the Amazon website if you liked our book and found it helpful and given us a 5-star review there. Really helps us take it to the next level.
Okay, we're going to jump right into this for pancreas for the AppSite. It's a very small organ, but it's a very big topic for the AppSite. So, John, let's jump right into it with a little bit of pathology. Most common being acute pancreatitis. What are the most common causes of acute pancreatitis?
So the most common causes of acute pancreatitis are alcohol and gallstones in the United States.
Okay, and woo. So gallstone pancreatitis, we mentioned gallstones is one of the most common causes of acute pancreatitis. We talked about this a little bit in our hepatobiliary section, but what's your main principles for treatment of gallstone pancreatitis?
Yeah, so once the pancreatitis is somewhat resolving, you should clear the duct with either an ERCP or an intraoperative cholangiogram, as well as do a cholecystectomy during the same admission.
Yeah, and that's going to be the key principle for that. So we talked a little bit earlier, go back and listen to the hepatobiliary area about how exactly to clear the duct and what the thinking is behind or what the philosophy is behind clearing the duct with gallstone pancreatitis. But cholecystectomy during the same admission, don't let those patients go home. There's a very high chance of recurrence, yeah. Serious recurrence at a 30-day interval. So, John, this was a big topic of our last year's AppSite review, but the Atlanta classification for post-pancreatic fluid collections, it's a new way of kind of breaking down acute pancreatitis. So can you walk us through the Atlanta classification?
Yeah, and this, like I said, is a new thing that a lot of older surgeons are still working on getting down because they used to classify it differently. The easiest way to go about this is to look at it as a non-necrotizing or necrotizing pancreatitis. And under the non-necrotizing pancreatitis, you have two different categories. You have acute peripancreatic fluid collection, where it is a fluid collection that's less than 4 weeks old, or you have a pseudocyst, which is greater than 4 weeks. Under the necrotizing pancreatitis category, you have a acute necrotic collection or fluid collection that's less than 4 weeks old, or you have a walled-off necrosis, which is considered anything greater than 4 weeks old.
Yeah, and as we mentioned in our prior review, the way that this will happen is they'll probably give you a CT scan. They'll give you a patient with acute pancreatitis. They'll give you a CT scan. They'll give you the timing interval, and they'll ask you, what is this? So again, the first division is it necrotizing or is it non-necrotizing? If it's non-necrotizing and you see a fluid collection, you look at the time interval, less than 4 weeks, acute peripancreatic fluid collection. If it's greater than 4 weeks, that's when you can call it a pseudocyst. With necrotizing pancreatitis, again, it's that 4-week time cutoff. If it's less than 4 weeks, it's an acute necrotic collection. If it's over 4 weeks, it's walled off necrosis. So not everything is a pseudocyst. If you see it, it looks like a pseudocyst on the CT scan. If it's necrotizing, the answer is walled off necrosis. So, for necrotizing pancreatitis, a common question is, do you treat these patients with antibiotics or not?
So the answer is no. The only time you treat with antibiotics for necrotizing pancreatitis is if you also have infection.
Okay, so no for necrotizing pancreatitis, yes for necrotizing pancreatitis with infection. So what are some signs then that you have an infection?
So look for clinical signs such as fever, elevated leukocytosis, but generally you're going to want some form of you're going to want some form of empiric evidence. And so get that CT-guided FNA, look for organisms, and then start treatment with imipenem.
Yep, imipenem is the antibiotic you want. You beat me to my next question, which was what antibiotic are you going to choose? So for infected, you know, pancreatitis, infected necrotizing pancreatitis, the choice is imipenem. John, what's the step-up approach?
The step-up approach is came out of a recent 2010 JAMA article that essentially showed that there are improved outcomes with delaying the OR and essentially going through these four steps. So when a patient comes in with infected pancreatic necrosis, the typical path was to take them directly to OR. Now it's shown that we will take this patient to the ICU, fluid resuscitate them, give them nutrition, supportive care. The second step is to start antibiotics, and these are all done obviously simultaneously. And then we want to drain this fluid collection that is found to be infected. At the third step, we will upsize the drain to really get that necrotic, nasty material outside from the retroperitoneum. And the fourth step is a video-assisted retroperitoneal drainage. And that would be your final final step, which would be complete your debridement.
Yeah. So if you look at, I know when I first started taking this test, if I was given the option of necrotizing pancreatitis, infected necrotizing pancreatitis, they'd give you a CT scan, they'd show you air, they'd probably give you a biopsy that showed organisms. The answer would be open pancreatic necrosectomy. And that wasn't that many years ago. But now, since this big JAMA article, the new standard of care, the things that show up on the boards is a step-up approach. So again, you're delaying the OR with ICU admission, fluid resuscitation, nutrition, supportive care. You're adding antibiotics. You're percutaneous draining, which you used to never answer percutaneous draining for this on the test. But now that's the answer. Upsizing the drain, and then your more minimally invasive approaches, the video-assisted retroperitoneal drainage. Okay, so moving on to chronic pancreatitis. A little bit different than acute pancreatitis, but what are some causes of chronic pancreatitis?
So chronic pancreatitis is secondary to long-standing alcohol abuse, to biliary tract disease, autoimmune or idiopathic in nature.
Okay, and how do these patients present?
They present with persistent abdominal pain, weight loss, pancreatic insufficiency, which can cause malabsorption, steatorrhea, diabetes. And all these patients have a history of one or more bouts of acute pancreatitis.
Okay, and what do you see? Keep going. What do you see on imaging with these patients?
So the standard is CT scan, and CT can confirm the diagnosis by demonstrating fibrosis, atrophy, and calcification of the gland.
John, what about is chronic pancreatitis, is that a risk for developing pancreatic cancer?
Chronic pancreatitis does increase your risk of developing a pancreatic cancer.
Okay, and how do you initially want to manage these patients when they show up with chronic pancreatitis?
So typically these patients won't come to a surgical services off the bat. You may be consulted for some other complication, but it's usually non-operative management. Pain control is important. They tend to be very painful in the epigastric region. Nutritional management, if they're currently using alcohol, make sure they've abstained from alcohol in the future after discharge or whatnot. And then pancreatic enzyme replacement.
And so we're going to move on a little bit to operative management of chronic pancreatitis, which is a very complex topic. And if you want an in-depth discussion of surgical management of chronic pancreatitis, I would refer back to our interview with Dr. Jeff Matthews, who is a leader in the field, and he gives a very thorough discussion of your different operative options for chronic pancreatitis. But for the abside, really, there's two main categories of operations for chronic pancreatitis: those that decompress an obstructed ductal system, and resection of the diseased tissue. One or the other, or a combination of the both. So let's go through a few of the common options for the seen on the abside. So the Pusteau procedure, what is that?
So the Pusteau procedure is a decompressive procedure. It is a longitudinal pancreaticojejunostomy.
Okay, and John, the Begger procedure?
So less well known as the Pusteau procedure, but it's a resection of the pancreatic head down to the duodenum, and either an end-to-end or side-to-side pancreatojejunostomy. It's a duodenum preserving pancreatic head resection.
Yeah, so resection, that's Begger's procedure, also known as the duodenum preserving pancreatic head resection, is a way to remember that. And Wu, the Frey procedure?
So the Frey procedure kind of combines the decompressive part of the pisto and then adds a little bit of a resection of diseased tissue. Essentially, it's a lateral longitudinal pancreaticojejunostomy with an excavation of the pancreatic head. So you are coring out the head of the pancreas, but you avoid a pancreatic transection that's required of the Baker procedure.
Okay, so which procedure you choose is going to depend on the particular morphology of the disease. So, John, walk me through some what's some different ways of thinking about this, how I decide what's the appropriate procedure.
So starting with the Pusteau procedure, which is indicated for large duct pancreatitis or chronic pancreatitis, where the duct is greater than 6 millimeters or not, and then as well as the pancreatic head is normal, this is the procedure you want to do for something like that. If the pancreatitis is pancreatic head dominant, with or without any duct dilation, you want to consider the Frey procedure. Now, if the distal pancreatic duct is strictured with normal or side branch changes and a normal pancreatic head, then you can also just consider a distal pancreatectomy.
Okay. And what about for, so yeah, let's go through those briefly just once again so people understand. So again, there's two different, there's decompressing dilated ducts and then there's resection of diseased tissue. So if you're dealing with just dilated ducts and the pancreatic head is normal, well, then your answer would be the Pusteau procedure because that's simple, that's decompression and you don't have to deal with the pancreatic head. If there is diseased tissue in the head of the pancreas, then you have to do one of these other procedures that involve decompressing the duct as well as removing some of that diseased tissue. And as John said, if it's a distal, if it's mainly involving the distal pancreas with strictures and side branch changes, then maybe a distal pancreatectomy is the right answer. What about, you hear about this thing called minimal change pancreatitis. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so this is unique because in these cases, resection or drainage are unlikely to help. So you should do a denervation operation. So essentially a bilateral thoracoscopic splanchnectomy.
Okay, so moving on, let's talk about a common complication or a common sequela of either acute or chronic pancreatitis, and that's a pseudocyst, which, again, going back to that Atlanta classification, where does pseudocyst fall into that classification?
So the first decision point was non-necrotizing versus necrotizing. So pseudocysts falls under the former, non-necrotizing. And then these occur beyond that 4-week cutoff. So acute peripancreatic fluid collections were less than 4 weeks. Pseudocysts are greater than 4 weeks.
Right. So this is that fluid collection after pancreatitis that's non-necrotizing that occurs after 4 weeks. Great. Okay, so John, tell me a little bit about pseudocyst. Who gets pseudocyst? Where is it more common?
So pseudocysts are more common in chronic pancreatitis patients. However, they can occur after a patient who has had a single episode of acute pancreatitis.
And what's your initial approach to this?
The initial approach to a patient who has a newly formed pseudocyst is that you want to manage these expectantly for at least 6 weeks. Most of the pseudocysts that develop will actually resolve in this time period, but it also gives us time to sit and wait and allow to the wall of the pseudocyst to mature. And then we can actually consider an intervention if the pseudocyst is enlarging or symptomatic or greater than 6 centimeters.
Yep, exactly. So you want to try to get them to a point where that wall can develop so that they will respond better to one of our interventions. And like you said, most will resolve. And the key kind of cutoffs for intervene are, of course, symptoms. If they continue to last without past that kind of 6 week, 3 month mark, or greater than 6 centimeters. That's kind of the generally 4 to 6 centimeters, but 6 centimeters definitely is kind of the generally accepted cutoff. So we know that these are often associated with other pancreatic duct abnormalities. So what's a key component to management? What do all these patients need before you take them to the operating room, Wu?
Yeah, so in the preoperative setting, you want to get an ERCP or an MRCP to assess the duct.
Yeah, so a lot of times they'll ask you, they'll give you kind of the situation of a patient with a pseudocyst. You know they need an intervention, but this is one of those famous what's the next step questions. So the next step is going to be image the duct. So it's either going to be an MRC or an ERCP. What are some different approaches to surgical management of pseudocyst?
So there are several different options. One is the transpapillary endoscopic stenting. Another is endoscopic transluminal drainage. A third is open cyst gastrostomy. And a fourth would be laparoscopic cyst gastrostomy.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different approaches, and it's going to depend on your experience, your institution, whether you have advanced endoscopic capabilities. How I would typically approach these on the board scenario. So if I'm giving a patient with persistent abdominal pain following pancreatitis and a contained fluid collection on the CT, I would, and again, we've met all those criteria. They're symptomatic. They're past the 6 weeks. You know, all those things we kind of said. First, I would image the ductal system first. So if that's the next step question, that's the ERCP or the MRCP. And then again, if it's been about 6 weeks, open or lap, a cyst gastrostomy would probably be the answer I would choose. Okay, moving on. So everybody's favorite, which is cystic neoplasms of the pancreas. How do these typically present?
So many are actually found incidentally on abdominal CTs done for other reasons. And then once they are found, MRCP will provide better characterization of the duct anatomy.
Yeah, like so everybody's getting cross-sectional abdominal imaging. You'll pick up these little things. The key is to get either, you know, a pancreatic dedicated triple phase CT scan or more commonly an MRI, MRCP for better characterization of the duct anatomy. What's the role of endoscopic ultrasound for these?
So EUS is actually very helpful as well. It allows for aspiration of the cyst fluid, and that can be analyzed for both CEA and amylase levels.
Yeah, perfect. So how is that going to change your management, though? So you have something, you're maybe not sure whether it's completely benign or whether it has some malignant potential. How do you kind of make that distinction?
Yeah, so the CEA in particular, if you have very high CEA levels, such as greater than 190, that would be consistent with a mucinous cyst. As far as the amylase level goes, high amylase typically points towards a ductal communication, such as with a pseudocyst or an IPM.
So, imaging characteristics for this, again, MRCP to get good imaging characteristics of this, adding the EUS to get an aspirate to find out what the CEA and amylase levels can help you kind of steer one way or the other. So let's talk through some of these management based on the different findings. So, John, let's say you're dealing with a serous cystadenoma. Tell me a little bit about those. How do they behave? What are some of their characteristics, and what do you do with them?
So serous cystadenoma, you would probably diagnose this when after doing your EOS and an aspirate, you would get a low CEA. These are predominantly benign lesions. They're well on imaging, you'd find them to be well circumscribed with characteristic a central stellate scar, and they only need to be resected if they're symptomatic or growing on serial imaging.
Yeah, so if they give you a cyst that, you know, is, again, we're all circumscribed, like John said, that central stellate scar on the imaging, that you have an aspirate that's low CEA, generally you do not need to resect these, especially on the boards type scenario. So, Wu, what about mucinous cystic neoplasms?
So, Jason, when you refer to mucinous, there is actually a distinction we need to make. One is there is a mucinous cystic neoplasm, but there's also a IPMN that is an entirely different category. So let's focus in on the mucinous cystic neoplasms. These are important because they have malignant potential. Radiographically, they're thick-walled. They will appear as a single cyst with internal septations. And when you get that EUS with FNA, they will have an elevated CEA level. The key here is that all mucinous cystic neoplasms should be resected in fit patients.
Yeah, so they'll give you the aspirate, and they'll either say that it has an elevated CEA, or they'll say that you see mucin in your aspirate, and that's a different category. Those have pretty decent malignant potential, so absolutely, all of those need to be resected. Now, you mentioned IPMN. John, what's IPMN, and how is it classified?
So IPMN, or intraductal papillary mucinous neoplasm, is categorized, in my thought, into three different groups. You have a main duct IPMN, a branch duct IPMN, and then you also have your mixed type IPMN. Mixed type is typically managed like a main duct IPMN.
That's absolutely right. So you have your main duct, you have your branch duct, and then you have the mixed, which you treat like a main duct IPMN. So tell me about first main duct IPMN. What are those, and how do you deal with those?
So main duct versus branch duct, the main ducts have a higher risk of malignancy than the branch duct. You have an endoscopic visualization of the fish mouth papilla, and this is pathognomonic for a main duct IPMN. Surgical resection is indicated for all main duct or mixed type IPMMs due to their high risk of malignancy.
Yeah, so that fish mouth papilla. So you have the mucin secreting from the patulous papilla. That is, anytime there's anything that's pathognomonic, you know it's going to show up on an exam. So they may give you somebody who has a cyst in the pancreas, and they do an endoscopy, and they see this finding. That is a main duct intraductal papillary mucinous neoplasm that needs surgical resection. Okay, John, keep going with the branch chain. How do those behave, and how do you go about dealing with those?
So branch duct, like I previously mentioned, have a lower risk of malignancy to the main duct. Their management is based on the Fukuoka guidelines, and the decision to resect is based on a multiple different things, like any procedure you perform. It's based on the fitness of the patient, the risk of tolerance of a big procedure, and then the individual characteristics. So you want to consider resection. So you'll take this patient to surgery for worrisome features. And these worrisome features are cyst size greater than 3 centimeters, a thickened cyst wall, non-enhancing mural nodules, lymphadenopathy, a main pancreatic duct greater than 10 millimeters, an abrupt change in the main pancreatic duct size with distal atrophy. So if you're looking at imaging and you have an endoscopic ultrasound, these worrisome features would be mural nodules, like I mentioned, main duct involvement. One thing to note about branch duct IPMMs is that in young patients, the cyst cutoff size is greater than 2 centimeters due to the larger risk of malignancy.
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack there. So with the other, you know, with the other lesions of the pancreas, the recommendations have been pretty straightforward. And it's this branch duct IPM that's a little bit special. And this is going to be a favorite for especially oral board type scenarios, just because there is a lot of variability. But essentially what it comes into is you have to balance, as with anything, balance the risk versus the benefits. It's not a benign surgery resecting parts of the pancreas. So you really have to weigh what's the risk of malignant potential in this patient with it's a conversation with the patient. What level of risk are they willing to accept for themselves versus undergoing this procedure? But in general, if you see worrisome features, like John mentioned, the cyst is greater than 3 centimeters. There's a thickened cyst wall, mural nodules, lymphadenopathy, dilated pancreatic duct. These are all worrisome things that push you to intervene rather than just watch. If on the ultrasound you see mural nodules, main duct involvement, suspicious cytology, certainly that increases the risk of malignancy. And that's going to guide that conversation to, hey, I think we should resect this. Younger patients who are surgically fit, you may be willing to resect ones that are a little bit smaller than that 3 centimeter cutoff. So consider for cysts greater than 2 centimeters. But again, it's a conversation between the patient and the physician and the risk they're willing to accept. But those are kind of some general cutoffs to know for boards type scenarios. So, Wu, the patient's gender and the patient's age may clue you into what you're dealing with, because a lot of these run more common in different demographics. What's a way of kind of breaking that up and thinking about it?
Yeah, so there's actually a mnemonic, the mother, daughter, grandmother sort of sequence here. So solitary pseudopapillary lesions are generally in the youngest set of patients. Your daughters will get solid pseudopapillary lesions. People in the mother age range, so in their fourth and fifth decades, will tend to get the mucinous type. Whereas older patients with a solitary pancreatic lesion think more in the line of serous pathology. And so for these patients, if they're not symptomatic, you can simply observe and not have to intervene.
Yeah, so these are just kind of, you know, general ways of breaking up and thinking about it, general guidelines. It's certainly not going to really guide your management. You still have to go through all the things, get all the imaging, you know, potentially get an aspirate. But yeah, almost exclusively affects women, and the age may deal with whether or not maybe you're dealing with something benign versus maybe you're dealing with something a little bit more serious. And again, this is for cystic neoplasms that we're dealing with. So just a way of kind of a little way to remember these. So moving on from our cystic neoplasms of the pancreas, let's move on to some solid tumors. And we'll start with the neuroendocrine tumors of the pancreas, or the PNETs. These can also be a little bit complicated, but if you break them up, and they're definitely manageable. So Wu, what are some general things to think about when it comes to the neuroendocrine tumors of the pancreas?
Yeah, so PNETs are rare, but highly tested. They only make up 1% to 2% of all pancreatic tumors. Frequently, they're non-functional, but they can also elaborate a number of bioactive peptides, so gastrin, glucagon, somatostatin, insulin, VIP. Think about all these peptides that are elaborated by the pancreas.
Yeah. And so, again, if these are kind of a daunting subject, the peanuts, but if you break them down, everything becomes manageable. So you think about the bioactive peptides that they secrete. If they're functional, the clinical presentation is going to follow those. So if you know what those do, it's easy. So first, let's talk about the most common, which is actually a non-functional pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor. John, tell me a little bit about those. What do we need to know?
So the majority of non-functional pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors are actually malignant, about 60 to 90%. Most are discovered late due to their asymptomatic nature. They can be discovered incidentally or secondary to like mass effects similar to the pancreatic adenocarcinoma. And they're generally very large during the discovery with a high metastasis rate. They're most commonly found in the head of the pancreas, and the patients with local regional disease should undergo resection.
Yeah, and as we move through these, everybody should be kind of visualizing. When we say a particular tumor, you should be thinking about benign versus malignant, what the risk of that is, their location, location within the pancreas. So evenly throughout, the head, the distal, and what the clinical syndrome is associated with them. And that'll help. And those are all things that everybody should know, because those are things that you may be asked. So a good way, and you can get tricked, because they may ask you, what's the most common functional tumor versus what's the most common tumor? Because the answer to that question is different. So Wu, what's the most common functional neuroendocrine tumor of the pancreas?
So the most common functional pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor is an insulinoma.
And so what's the most common peanut?
A non-functional.
So you have to really look at the way the question's asked. So just keep that in your mind as we're moving through these. So moving on to the most common functional neuroendocrine tumor of the pancreas, the insulinoma, Wu. How do we think about those?
Yeah, so most of these are benign, so 90% benign. They're located throughout the pancreas, so evenly distributed. And the syndrome they're associated with is Whipple's triad, so a fasting hypoglycemia, neuroglycopenic symptoms such as confusion, combativeness, seizures, visual changes, or loss of consciousness, as well as relief of these symptoms with the administration of glucose.
Okay, so let's say we have somebody we suspect has an insulinoma. What are some biochemical tests that can help us confirm the diagnosis?
So look for signs and symptoms with a plasma glucose of less than 55, insulin level greater than 18, and a C-peptide that is 0.6 or greater, as well as a pro-insulin level that's 5. Or on top of these, look for a beta-hydroxybutyrate of 2.7 or less, and an increase in plasma glucose of at least 25 after the administration of glucagon, and finally a negative urine test for an oral hypoglycemic.
Now, I don't think they're asking each one of those individually on the boards, but for me, it's just good to know, like, the patient has to meet all those criteria in order to really meet the diagnosis of insulinoma. So there's a whole biochemical panel that goes into making this diagnosis. But certainly, the big hits are knowing that there's symptoms associated with hypoglycemia, that the insulin is high in insulinoma, obviously, and the C-peptide. Why is that important, Wu?
So you want to think about whether this patient is driving down their own insulin level and glucose level, or if this is because of an exogenous source.
Yeah, they'll always give you a nurse, I don't know why, they'll say a nurse presents with this, and you have to kind of distinguish whether or not it's self-injecting with insulin versus whether or not it's endogenous or an insulinoma. So that's why that C-peptide is important. So if the biochemical tests are positive, what do you need to do, John?
So then we move on to our localization studies, similar to pretty much any pancreatic lesion. So you want to get a triphasic pancreatic CT or an MRI. If they ask you which one's more sensitive, you're going to say they're equally. The second one is do an endoscopic ultrasound. The third step is if you're unable to localize the tumor, do a selective intra-arterial calcium injection with hepatic venous sampling for insulin. And then the important thing to note with insulinomas, unlike the majority of the peanuts, is that a somatostatin scintigraphy is not effective in these tumors.
Right. So this is the one where a somatostatin test is not going to help you. It will not localize. So it's a stepwise approach. So you start with your cross-sectional imaging, your CT, your pancreatic dedicated CT, or your MRI. If you don't see anything there, then you move on to endoscopic ultrasound. Those are a little bit more sensitive. And then you're going into the more invasive. So start with least and go to more invasive, which is your selective intra-arterial calcium injection and hepatic vein sampling for insulin. Okay, so let's say you've made your diagnosis, you have your localization, and how do you treat these?
So treatment for insulinoma depends on location, as well as your suspicion from malignancy, and finally the presence of any other tumors. So if you have a solitary benign appearing tumor, these can be treated simply with enucleation. If you have a distal tumor, that can be treated with a distal spleen preserving pancreatectomy. And finally, if you have suspicion for malignancy, that would actually require a formal resection.
Great. So the majority of these are probably going to be solitary benign appearing lesions that you can be enucleation, but definitely need to know the other steps too. Okay, moving on. John, gastrinoma. What are some general things to know about gastrinoma?
So about 60 to 90% of gastrinomas are malignant. Gastrin will increase the acid secretion from the parietal cells. And two-thirds of these tumors are located within the gastrinoma triangle.
And what's that? What's the gastrinoma triangle?
So the gastrinoma triangle is the junction of the cystic duct and common bile duct. The second wall is the junction of the second and third portions of the duodenum. And the third portion is the, or third wall is the junction of the neck and the body of the pancreas, forming a triangle.
Right. And again, as we're going through these, when we say them, think about, are they mostly benign? Are they mostly malignant? How do they behave and where are they located? Those are key things you need to know, those three things for each one of these. Okay, what's the clinical presentation, John?
So these also present with a classic triad: abdominal pain, diarrhea, and weight loss in the presence of peptic ulcer disease. So typically these patients are found after they've had longstanding ulcer disease and they finally get worked up.
Okay, so let's say you have a suspicion. How do you make the diagnosis?
So some of the diagnostic and confirmatory tests you can do for gastrinomas is that you can measure a gastrin level. You can do this as a fasting gastrin level, which maybe has to be associated with a low gastric pH and a high basal output. So the use of PPIs and H2 blockers will actually raise your gastrin level. So you need to stop these prior to testing your gastrin level. Your fasting gastrin level greater than 1,000 is diagnostic. Elevated levels less than 1,000 will usually take you to a secretin stimulation test. So gastrinomas, if you have a gastrinoma, will have a paradoxical effect on secretin. It will increase the gastrin levels will actually increase greater than 200 with the administration of secretin versus decreasing in normal patients.
So yeah, so like what's a normal reaction to secretin? So if I gave you secretin, what would happen to your gastrin levels?
They would drop.
So in these patients with the gastrinoma, they respond paradoxically. So if you have the number greater than 1,000, and as you said, they have to have a low pH or a high acid output in their stomach, so they can't be taking a PPI because that's going to raise their gastrin level. So, but if they have a true hypergastrin level state with a low gastric pH, and their gastrin levels are greater than 1,000, done. You have your diagnosis. But if they're in that kind of gray zone, you can do the secretin stimulation test, exactly as you said. Okay, so walk us through. That's positive. Now you got to find the thing. How are you going to localize it?
So like I said before, it's similar. You start off with your triphasic pancreatic CT or MRI. The next thing is this where you would use your somatin receptor scintigraphy, which it's effective in gastrinomas. Next, you want to do an endoscopic ultrasound. And if you still can't localize it, similar to an insulinoma, you do a selective intra-arterial calcium injection with hepatic venous sampling for gastrin.
Yeah, that's going to be a little bit institution specific, but certainly start with your cross-sectional imaging, your somatostatin scan, ultrasound, then potentially selective arterial injection. Like I said, least invasive to most invasive. But let's say you do all that and you still can't find it. What do you do then?
Well, this is the fun part for a surgeon. You get to take that patient to the operating room and try to find this thing in the OR. So you do an intraoperative ultrasound. You can do a transduodenal palpation. You can do an intraoperative upper endoscopy with transduodenal illumination trying to find the mass. And then finally, if you still can't find it after all that, you can do a duodenotomy and then palpate the head of the pancreas.
Right. Again, you're searching within that gastrinoma triangle to try and find this thing. Okay, John, what about treatment for these?
If you have a tumor in the duodenal mucosa, you can then do enucleation and periduodenal lymph node dissection. If you have a non-invasive tumor 5 centimeters or smaller in the head of the pancreas, you can do enucleation with periduodenal lymph node dissection. Tumors greater than 5 centimeters or if they're invasive in the head of the pancreas, we'll need a Whipple. If you have a tumor in the body or tail of the pancreas, then you can do a distal pancreatectomy.
Yeah, so that's a little bit, I mean, these have a pretty high malignant potential, but you can't, depending on the location, depending on their depth of invasion, you can still enucleate them. The key there is you need to do a lymph node dissection, a lymph node harvest. So again, the duodenal mucosa, small, you can do the enucleation, paraduodenal lymph node dissection. 5 centimeters or smaller in the head and pancreas, you can do an enucleation, but again, you have to get the lymph nodes. Anything larger than that, anything invasive, you have to do a formal resection, which would either involve a Whipple or a distal pancreatectomy. Okay, moving on. Let's talk about glucagonoma. Tell us a few key points.
Yeah, so glucagonomas are mostly malignant. So 90% of these are malignant. Their most common location is the tail of the pancreas. As far as their presentation, think of the four Ds: dermatitis, diabetes, depression, and DVTs. The DVTs are secondary to a factor 10-like antigen that's secreted by this tumor. Characteristic of glucagonomas is a skin rash. It's called necrolytic migratory erythema. And I've actually seen questions where they show you a patient with this skin rash. And then the most common finding in terms of a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor associated with the skin rash is the glucagonoma.
Yeah, so definitely, if you don't know what it looks like, the necrolytic migratory erythema, Google image it. Make sure you sear that in your brain because it might show up as an image on the test. So how do you make the diagnosis?
So for diagnosis, you want to check for glucose intolerance with a fasting glucagon level that's between 1,000 and 5,000.
Okay. And as with everything, you make your diagnosis is positive. How do you localize?
Mm-hmm. So same sequence. Start with a triphasic CT or an MRI. Second, you can do the somatostatin receptor scintigraphy. Again, remember, for insulinomas, this is not effective. But for glucagonomas, it is effective. Third, use your endoscopic ultrasound. And fourth, you can do selective visceral angiography.
Yeah, so hopefully people are noticing a theme when it comes to, there's a lot of overlap when it comes to approaching these, trying to sort them out, trying to localize them. Okay, so you found it. How do you treat it?
So the big thing to remember here is no enucleation. There is a high malignant potential, so you will not be able to do a simple enucleation procedure like your insulinoma or your gastrinoma. For glucagonomas, you're going to do a resection with a regional lymphadenectomy. Usually, this is a distal pancreatectomy. Remember, as far as the symptoms that this patient presented with, and you're going to do a cholecystectomy due to the prolonged need for somatostatin therapy.
Again, yeah, it's a 90% malignant, so you treat this as a malignancy. So you do a formal resection. Like you said, they're most commonly located in the tail, so distal pancreatectomy is most likely going to be your procedure. And you think about some adjuvant therapies, it's going to be somatostatin. So if you're going to be treating someone with somatostatin, you need to be sure to take their gallbladder out. It's not a very kind thing to do, to leave it in and then give them somatostatin because they will develop gallstones. Great. Okay. We're moving on with these. There's a lot of them. So somatostatinoma, walk us through it. What are they? How do they behave?
Somatostatinoma secretes somatostatin, which it turns everything off in its inhibitory activity in the GI tract. The majority of these tumors are actually malignant. They're most commonly found in the head of the pancreas. You can also find them in the second portion of the duodenum. And they can be associated with cholecystitis, diabetes mellitus, malabsorption, and steroidea.
Yep. So again, you think just if you know what the biological agent does, you can predict what the clinical syndrome is going to be. So again, cholecystitis, diabetes, malabsorption, steatorrhea, it's secreting somatostatin. It makes sense. How do you go about finding these?
So like all the other PNETs, triphasic CT or MRI, scintigraphy, endoscopic ultrasound, and then selective arteriography if you cannot find it after that.
Yep, these are all just variations on a theme. Okay, so treatment, you said they're mostly malignant, so what's the treatment going to be?
You want to resect them with regional lymphadenectomy, and because you don't want to enucleate these similar to the glucagonomas because of high malignant potential.
And?
and cholecystectomy.
Cholecystectomy. This one just makes sense. So you have elevated levels of somatostatin, you're going to have gallbladder pathology. So cholecystectomy in addition to resection. A VIPoma. VIPoma. What is that? How does it behave? Where is it located?
So VIPomas are mostly malignant. They're most commonly located in the body or the tail of the pancreas. Do note, though, that extra pancreatic locations are possible. And with these, you want to think about the adrenal, the retroperitoneum, and the mediastinum. They are associated with a WDHA syndrome, which is watery diarrhea, hypokalemia, and achlorhydria.
Yep, and they'll give you that patient, and they'll tell you what diagnostic test you want to run.
So here you want to check a fasting VIP level, which will be elevated when diarrhea is present.
And how do you localize?
So same thing. Start with a triphasic CT or MRI, then move on to somatostatin receptor scintigraphy. Third is endoscopic ultrasound, and fourth is selective arteriography.
Treatment.
Treatment is resection with a regional lymphadenectomy. Again, no enucleation due to the high malignant potential, and close out with a cholecystectomy.
Yep. Again, these are patients that you might use somatostatin for adjuvant therapy. It's malignant. You got to resect it. And you definitely want to add that cholecystectomy. Okay, we are done with our pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. Yep. Just go back and listen to that one 3 or 4 times. Get that seared in your memory. It's all just variations on a theme. And again, know where they are, know how they behave, know what the clinical syndrome is associated with them. If you know what the biological agent does, you know how it affects the individual. Okay, so big topic next, pancreatic adenocarcinoma. This could be a podcast in and of itself, but we're just going to cover some highlights that you need to know for your boards. So, John, what are some risk factors for pancreatic adenocarcinoma?
So, cigarette smoking, heavy alcohol use, history of chronic pancreatitis, patient with increased BMI, and long-standing diabetes.
Okay, and how do you want to, a lot of times, you know, the patient either presents with signs of obstruction, or these are found incidentally in cross-sectional imaging. What kind of imaging do you want to make sure you have when you're evaluating these?
Yeah, like you mentioned, these patients will, you know, typically present with painless jaundice as the pathognomonic for pancreatic adenocarcinoma, but you would get a pancreatic protocol CT. This will eventually lead you to endoscopy with possible endoscopic ultrasound, and then you can do a biopsies of any questionable lymph nodes or anything in that area. And then if you are you have diagnosed your pancreatic adenocarcinoma and you are concerned for metastases, you want to further work these patients up with a PET CT.
Yeah, so this is all goes into, you know, part of our staging algorithm. You know, we're trying to decide whether or not a particular lesion is resectable or not. So you certainly need your pancreatic protocol a CT. You'll need a CT oncology or a CT chest, abdomen, pelvis, looking for any signs of metastasis. If there's question of some lymph nodes involved, certainly endoscopic ultrasound with selective biopsy may be useful. Again, you're just trying to find out if this is something we can operate on or not. And then PET CT is used selectively. What about the role of, you have a concerning lesion in the pancreas, you think it's maybe pancreatic adenocarcinoma. John, what's the role of biopsy?
A biopsy is a helpful adjunct if you hit it, but a pathologic diagnosis is not required prior to resection. It is needed prior to new adjuvant therapy or if you have an unresectable mass prior to definitive chemotherapy.
Yeah, this is one of the things, if the clinical scenario fits and the imaging fits, you proceed immediately to resection. You don't need a biopsy. If, on the other hand, there's maybe some diagnostic uncertainty or maybe it's unresectable, certainly your medical and radiation oncologists are not going to treat them without a tissue diagnosis, so it is useful there. But as part of your staging, not necessary. Okay, you have a lesion that you think is resectable on imaging. It appears consistent with a pancreatic adenocarcinoma. You decide you're going to resect it. What's the role of a staging laparoscopy?
Staging laparoscopy is something that, you know, will come up in M&M a lot, where like, why didn't you look with a scope first? But it's controversial. A lot of people will use it routinely. Some people will use it selectively in patients that are high risk for disseminated disease. You have patients based on imaging modalities that you have possibly borderline resectable, a very high 19.9, or a large primary tumor, if you have a many regional lymph nodes, and if the patient's very symptomatic.
Yeah, again, as we mentioned before, a lot of these controversial things not likely to show up on boards, but it's important to know that it's an option, and some people do it routinely. Okay, another thing that frequently comes up, you said that these patients often, or John, you said these patients often present with painless jaundice. Woo. So you have a patient, painless jaundice, has a pancreatic head mass. What's the role of biliary drainage? It's like stenting procedures. What's the role of that in these patients?
So yeah, although it's true that they presented with symptoms of obstructive jaundice, there is actually no effect of survival in terms of preoperative biliary drainage. But the preoperative biliary drainage is associated with increased wound infection rates, so generally you're not going to do it. For resectable disease in patients not undergoing neoadjuvant therapy, you might consider if the patient has profound pruritus, cholangitis, or has coagulopathy. And again, in patients who are undergoing neoadjuvant therapy and you're not going to go on to surgery first, if they have profound jaundice, it might be a consideration.
Right. So if you have a resectable disease and you have obstructed duct, and a patient that's otherwise ready for surgery, just proceed to surgery. There's no indication for preoperative biliary drainage. In fact, it may lead to higher rates of infection. So again, you're going to look if the patient is severe, you know, significantly symptomatic from their jaundice, pruritus, you may consider it, especially if it's going to be a little while before you're able to proceed with resection. So there's a couple different kinds of stents out there. There's plastic stents, there are metal stents. Let's say you do have a patient that you are going to put a stent in. What's the preferred stent and what's the difference?
So the best type of stent to choose would be a self-expanding metal stent. And the reason these are preferred is because, one, they're easy to place without dilation. And two, they tend to have longer patency rates than the plastic stents. And third, they don't interfere with the subsequent resection.
Right. So if you are going to stent, if the patient's symptomatic, they're going for new adjuvant therapy, the self-expanding metal stent would probably be the correct answer there. So when we think about these patients, we break them up into, when we think about patients' resectability, we break it up into resectable, borderline resectable, and unresectable. John, what's considered resectable pancreatic adenocarcinoma?
A resectable tumor is a tumor that has no arterial contact, less than 180 degrees of contact with the SMV or portal vein, without any vein contour irregularity.
Perfect. So again, no arterial contact or less than 180 degree contact with the SMV and portal vein contact. You want to look at that CT. You want to make sure that there's no contour irregularity, which would indicate invasion into the vascular structure. Woo, what's borderline resectable?
So for the borderline resectable patient, think about that patient with tumor contact with the SMA or celiac that is less than 180 degrees. Or tumor contact with a common hepatic only, so no celiac or proper hepatic arterial involvement, which would allow for subsequent resection and reconstruction. Or you could have involvement of the SMV or portal vein that is amenable to resection and reconstruction. Finally, you might have certain cases where there is tumor contact with the IVC that might be considered borderline resectable.
Yeah, okay. And John, unresectable?
So any patient with distant metastases, if you have greater than 180 degree contact with the SMA or celiac, or if you have an unreconstructable involvement of the SMV or portal vein, or it depends what surgeon you're operating with.
Yeah, exactly. So again, they're probably not going to get, they may give you a tumor and ask if it's resectable or if it's unresectable. I doubt they're going to give you one of those borderline resectable type of scenarios. It's either going to be pretty cut and dry. But certainly any arterial contact or anything that's invading a vein that's not resectable, that would be unresectable. And those were the common situations I would look for on the boards. Okay, what are your kind of treatment options when it comes to pancreatic adenocarcinoma?
Yeah, so let's start with the topic of primary surgery and when patients might benefit from surgery. So if you have patients that have a distal tumor, again, remember that these patients are presenting typically without symptoms at first, and so they present late and are usually too advanced at the time of diagnosis for resection. But if they are amenable to resection, that would be a distal pancreatectomy and splenectomy.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the location is going to depend a lot, or is going to affect how these tumors behave and the treatment for them. So let's say you have a resectable tumor at the head of the pancreas. What's your procedure?
In that case, the procedure would be a Whipple procedure or a pancreatic duodenectomy.
Okay, Sean, let's say you're in the operating room. You thought the tumor was resectable, but now you've found, you're already in the operating room, your abdomen's open, and you can feel that there's invasion into the celiac trunk. What do you want to think about in that situation?
So this is important to note the patient's symptoms prior to going to the operating room. So if you do find a patient that is unresectable, you may want to consider a couple of different things. The first thing is consider a palliative biliary bypass if you're having obstructive jaundice, as well as a gastroduodenoscopy if you're actually having obstruction the patient cannot eat, or if they're having a significant amount of pain, you want to consider a celiac plexus neurolysis.
Perfect. And we mentioned this already, but so let's say there is some, you get in the operating room and there is some portal venous or some SMV involvement. What do you want to think about, and what are some key things to know about that disease process?
Yeah, so you're really going to benefit the patient most by doing that full R0 resection. And if that results in you getting into that portal vein or SMV, just make sure you follow that up with resection and reconstruction of those venous structures.
All right, let's move on a little bit of perioperative therapy. So who gets neoadjuvant therapy?
So for perioperative therapy, this includes both chemo and radiation. But for neoadjuvant therapy, you should consider this in patients with borderline resectable disease. And again, as Jason mentioned earlier, you need that EUS with FNA for a tissue diagnosis prior to starting this.
Yep. So that's one of the indications for getting a biopsy, which, like I said, you don't need before you resect. But if you have something that's borderline resectable or unresectable, obviously, and you need to give some chemo radiation, you're going to need a tissue diagnosis. So neoadjuvant chemo rads for people who have borderline resectable disease. Good. And to go back again, that's somebody you may consider decompressing the biliary system if they're symptomatic for that, if somebody is getting neoadjuvant therapy. So, John, let's say after you do your resection, you have an R0 resection, who gets adjuvant therapy?
So somebody once told me that the Whipple procedure for pancreatic adenocarcinoma is actually just a palliative procedure. So everyone gets adjuvant therapy. And generally, this is FOLFIRINOX, folinic acid, fluorouracil, irinotecan, and oxyplatin.
Perfect. Okay, so that is our quick kind of what you need, down and dirty, what you need to know for the boards of pancreatic adenocarcinoma. Certainly an expansive topic that we could spend a lot of time on. So that is wrapping up our pancreas discussion. Let's move on to our quick hits. So Wu, patient with a history of multiple episodes of pancreatitis now presents with hematemesis. What are you thinking?
So think about gastric varices from splenic vein thrombosis. The treatment is splenectomy.
Yep. So your most common cause of splenic vein thrombosis is pancreatitis. That results in gastric varices. Splenectomy is curative of those. Okay, John, you have a patient with multiple branch duct IPMNs on imaging. There are multiple small benign appearing cysts throughout the proximal pancreatic body with a larger dominant one more distally and worrisome features. So you have multiple IPMNs, multiple branch, you have one that looks worrisome. How do you deal with that patient?
So you want to resect the most dominant distal lesion, and you can leave the smaller benign ones behind, but they'll just need surveillance.
Yeah, and that's important to know because there's these branch chain IPMNs frequently present with multiple cysts, so you kind of have to know how to approach that. Okay, Wu, 48-year-old patient incidentally diagnosed with a 2-centimeter branch chain IPMN on abdominal CT. She has microcytic anemia on her laboratory workup. And what else does she need as part of her workup?
So cluing in on that anemia, the patient needs a colonoscopy.
Why?
So recall that IPMN patients have a higher incidence of extra pancreatic malignancies, and most commonly this is colonic adenocarcinoma.
Very good. Very good. So, John, we talked extensively about neuroendocrine tumors of the pancreas. What is a syndrome that's associated that we used to think about when you think about neuroendocrine tumors of the pancreas?
So you have to think of MEN1, multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1. So usually the tumors associated with this syndrome actually are non-functional, but the most common functional tumor is a gastrinoma. Just a reminder, the most common PNET tumor overall is a non-functional, and the most common functional tumor outside of MEN1 is an insulinoma.
Right. So that's you have to be very careful about how those questions are worded and what you're going to answer there. So just know that inside out. So Wu, patient presents with episodes of fasting, hypoglycemia, and dizziness that resolved with glucose administration. What is that?
So I'm assuming the C-peptide here is going to be low.
No, don't worry about that. Just what is that those three things? What's the name of that triad?
Whipple's triad.
Okay. So then you mentioned C-peptide. So we check the C-peptide. The C-peptide is low. What's your diagnosis?
So here you got to think about exogenous insulin administration. So it's a factitious disorder.
Okay. What if the C-peptide was high? John, so what's your medical management of a functional neuroendocrine tumor of the pancreas?
Either preoperative, postoperatively, it's octreotide, except for insulinomas who do not respond to somatostatin and cannot be localized using the somatostatin scintigraphy.
Yep. So insulinoma is a little bit unique when it comes to neuroendocrine tumors and the fact that you can't localize it with a somatostatin scan. And it makes sense then that it doesn't have somatostatin receptors, so it's not going to respond to octreotide. So Wu, what are some mutations associated with pancreatic adenocarcinoma? These for some reason show up every once in a while, especially in written boards type scenarios.
So the top four you want to think about are KRAS, P53, CDKN2A, and SMAD4.
Yeah, I think most commonly seeing the KRAS and the P53, but certainly those other two are the ones that if you're the 100th percentile person instead of the 99th percentile person, you may need to know those. Okay, John, biomarkers associated with pancreatic adenocarcinoma.
Well, there are a lot of them, but the only one I can think of really off the top of my head is CA19-9.
Yeah, that's that's the one you need to know. That's the one that's the most validated and most clinically useful. Okay, Wu. So during a Whipple procedure for pancreatic adenocarcinoma, you encounter a clinically positive lymph node outside the field of resection. You're going to have several options. Should you leave it alone? Should you perform a regional lymphadenectomy? Should you sample the node but not perform the complete regional lymphadenectomy? What should you do?
So you should sample the node but not perform the complete regional lymphadenectomy.
Why is that?
The reason is that nodal metastasis, it's a marker of systemic disease, and so removing the node is unlikely to alter the overall survival. And really, outside of a clinical trial, a regional lymphadenectomy should not be performed during the Whipple.
Especially on the boards. For me, that's one of the hardest parts. I think that the exam actually got harder as I went up in my residency because I started seeing people doing more and more things. And when I got to a question, I would be like, well, Dr. So-and-so would do it this way. Dr. So-and-so would do it this way. But for the boards, that's absolutely correct. That's the right answer. All right. Well, that wraps it up. That was a big topic, but we got through it. That was our pancreas review for Abcite and the boards.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org for more great content. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please take a minute to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening.
Until next time, dominate the day.